Can we hold providers accountable for what happens to people in their interactions with the healthcare system?
Does lowering cholesterol affect cognition?
Do we finally know whether it's better to be on pump or off pump with regard to coronary artery bypass grafting?
And cannabis for pain and post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on August 18th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, why don't we turn right to Annals of Internal Medicine, this ongoing issue about medical marijuana. Is there any benefit to it at all? In this case, there are two studies taking a look at it in two applications and coming to sort of lackluster conclusions.
You're aware that 8 states and the District of Columbia have actually legalized cannabis for recreational purposes, but more importantly, 28 states and the District of Columbia have actually legalized it for medical purposes. And somewhere between 45 and 80% of persons who seek medical cannabis do so for the management of pain, and about a third do so for management of post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll call it PTSD. So there are two articles, one that looked at each of those conditions, and as you mentioned, they came to fairly lackluster conclusions. With regard to using cannabis in adults with chronic pain, there are very few studies and very limited evidence suggesting that cannabis may alleviate neuropathic pain in some patients, but there's really no evidence that it reduces pain in other conditions. Post-traumatic stress disorder. Again, there are really no randomized control trials, but observational trials don't provide any evidence that it decreases PTSD symptoms. In fact, one of them suggests that it may, in fact, worsen them.
So insufficient evidence to draw conclusions about either benefits or harms. Does this suggest to you that we need to design a better study?
There are several well-designed randomized control trials currently underway. Now, we won't have that data for another 2 years. So I think it's important for our listeners to know that despite its use, there's no good data. I find this actually kind of interesting. We would never approve a drug through the FDA not knowing what are the benefits or harms. But here in 28 states and in Washington, D.C., it's approved for medical use really with no data at all.
A curiosity, and I guess I'm hearing a lot of anecdotal reports about Colorado especially, where the legalization of it has turned into kind of a nightmare.
In what way, Elizabeth?
I think socially it's turned into one.
It was interesting to me to know that among patients who are prescribed long-term opioid therapy for pain, about 40% of them are also using cannabis as well. This suggests that it may be being abused rather than used for proper medical conditions.
Okay, we're watching, of course. Since we're in Annals, let's stay there. I served it up as, wow, can we hold providers responsible for outcomes people experience in their interactions with the healthcare system?
Most of us are familiar with the fact that doctors in particular, and even hospitals, in the past were paid for how many procedures were done, payment for volume. Now there's been a switch to making sure that the payment is actually tied to some value. We're turning to payment based upon outcomes. Well, if we're going to do that, there has to be some basic principles. The authors propose if we're going to look at outcomes, the criteria should include the fact that there should be strong evidence that good medical care leads to improvement in the outcome. Secondly, the outcome should be measured with a high degree of precision. But a lot of the data we get is from claims data from the insurance, and it's really not very precise. The third thing is we need to have some risk adjustment, because not every patient's the same and not all diseases have the same severity. And finally, the measure that we implement shouldn't have some adverse effect. So for example, if our outcome is survival in 30 days and someone has a limiting stroke and we know they're not going to survive, but our whole goal is just to get them to that 31st or 32nd day, then what we've done is we've actually adversely affected their outcome. Now what they did was they looked at 10 of the 40 outcomes that are currently being measured, and only 3 of the 10 met all 4 criteria. So we still have a lot to do if we're going to use outcomes as our way of gauging value and payment.
And I guess I would suggest to you that physicians as a group are pretty smart and are capable of gaming the system. And so the workarounds, as you've suggested, making sure somebody survives long enough or making sure that they don't or that they're discharged or whatever, are all ways to game that system. And I'm not sure what we can implement that would eliminate that possibility.
And I'll take it a step further. It's not just physicians, it's actually hospital systems, because their payment is based upon this. We have a lot of work to do before we use these outcomes as a way of determining whether, first of all, we're providing great quality, and secondly, of whether that's a proper way to incentivize healthcare providers and healthcare systems.
So let's put a challenge out there to our very large and abundant physician audience. Gosh, what measures would you use, would you employ? And we'd love to hear that from you. Let's turn from here then to the New England Journal of Medicine. I said, do we finally know the answer to whether one should be on pump or off pump when you have coronary artery bypass grafting, abbreviated CABBAGE? And I'll just remind everyone that when you're off pump, they do it with the beating heart. When you're on pump, they stop it.
And the reason why this became an issue is when you take someone and you arrest their heart and put them on pump, there are some potential side effects. Running the blood through the machine actually tears up some of the cells. It can cause inflammation, and it's thought to increase the risk of stroke. The downside is if you operate on a beating heart, it's technically more challenging, and the results may not be as durable. So which is the best technique? And this is a five-year follow-up on a study that's previously been reported after 1 year. This is a large study, over 2,200 patients that were operated on 18 different medical centers, either randomized to on or off pump CABBAGE. What they discovered at the end of 5 years, the five-year survival off pump was 15.2%, 11.9% in the on pump group. Then if you look at the composite of death from any cause, do they need to have a repeat procedure, either another surgery or stenting, or do they have a heart attack? That rate was higher in off pump than on pump, 31% versus 27%.
I really like this study, and I'm really glad to have this outcome because this controversy has swirled for a very long time. One of the criticisms, as you're well aware, and that we've reported on previously, has been that when someone's heart is arrested, do they suffer an increased rate of, I'm going to call it, cognitive decline after surgery? How about that factor?
That wasn't analyzed in this particular study. If you look at studies in total, they would suggest that, in fact, there's really no increase in cognitive decline in being on pump versus off pump. These are relatively lower moderate risk individuals. There are some individuals that are considered to be extremely high risk, and those patients may, in fact, benefit from having their surgery done off pump.
And I'm going to consider that the last word. Finally, let's turn to another study in NEJM. This one's taking a look at cognitive function. Gosh, that was such a segue. I didn't even know I was headed there. With cognitive function and evolucumab.
This is one of the new medications that lowers cholesterol. It's not a statin. It's called a PCSK9 inhibitor. And for individuals that are already on a statin and their cholesterol doesn't get lowered sufficiently, the addition of PCSK9 inhibitors can dramatically lower cholesterol. And it's been shown to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events. The downside is these PCSK9 inhibitors have to be administered via an injection. And right now they're pretty expensive. It costs about $14,000 a year for this therapy. But it is effective. In some of the early trials, moderate-sized trials and some meta-analysis, it raised concern about whether lowering cholesterol with this particular agent led to a decline in cognitive function. Now, by the way, I have to admit that this was a whole theory when we talked about statins. So what these investigators did, they looked at a subgroup of patients from a randomized placebo-controlled trial that's already been done. This subgroup was a group of about 1,200 patients in which they had cognitive function tests using a very standard neuropsychologic test. They had their executive function tested, they had their working memory tested, their episodic memory, and their psychomotor speed as well. And these individuals were placed on a PCSK9 inhibitors or placebo for over 19 months. And what they discovered is when you look at all individuals over 19 months, there's no surprise that there was a small decline in all these functions. That's the aging process. But when they compared placebo to evolucumab, there was no difference. Evolucumab did not increase the rapidity of the cognitive decline or the severity of it. Furthermore, they even looked at it for those individuals that had the lowest LDL cholesterol, that is an LDL cholesterol of less than 25, and those individuals did not have a more rapid decline in cognitive function as well. So this should reassure us that lowering cholesterol with this particular agent, at least in the short term, doesn't contribute to cognitive dysfunction.
Did you tell me how many people were in this study?
There were over 1,200 patients in this trial.
And it went on for how long?
For 19 months. So the limitations of the trial are we don't have long-term follow-up. The second is that they excluded people that already had mild cognitive dysfunction or dementia. So we have no way of knowing how this agent works in these particular individuals. But those limitations aside, I think this is a very well done study.
Those PCSK9 inhibitors, of course, looking like they're going to get used a lot more often, although they've got some distinct disadvantages.
And we've talked about two of them. One is the need to administer via injection. The major disadvantage right now is the cost.
probably come down, I guess. On that note, I'm going to discuss the two studies in Annals of Internal Medicine on cannabis for pain and post-traumatic stress disorder on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.